Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. You know, I intended to publish my interview with John Michael Gaudier today, but that'll be pushed back. I'll publish this on the 1st of May, since, well, that's a neat day because I have to wrap around this month. Because so many things have happened, and I've had so many news and everything, and I've gotten comments about my last episodes not being very journalistic again. Well, here you go. Have a really fact-heavy episode for which I really pushed back a more narrative-oriented one about science and Soviet Union and how Soviets saw the future. By the way, check out Event Horizon podcast or check out John Michael Gaudier on YouTube. He's a great guy, and I was honored to be finally have a talk with some science podcasters and YouTubers. It was great, and I wish I'll do that in the future when I figure out what's what can I talk to them about. Turns out some of them are history fans. Who knew? But yeah, we have a lot of things. First of all, and like a short digest about everything, because we're going to be looking at Igor Girkin's stakes and some economy news. But most important stuff that has happened today is that, well, the Parliamentary Assembly of the European Council basically just supported today a creation of an international tribunal in accordance to Russian war crimes, which is great. The Parliament of Canada unanimously admitted today that the actions of Russian soldiers in Ukraine are genocide, which is, well, great. In Belgorod, the city in Russia next to the Ukrainian border, once again, air defense systems had started working, because right now Ukraine is getting more capabilities to actually strike targets inside of Russia. They don't have a lot of it, but they are now using these capabilities to strike oil bases and other logistics targets, thus continuing the Ukrainian strategy of, you know, defending but striking the logistics targets to wear down the Russian opposition. And we'll get to this more when I give my comments on Igor Girkin's takes on the direct situation on the front. Finland have decided to not to pay in rubles for Russian gas, which I applaud too. On contrast, Hungary has agreed to pay for the Russian gas in rubles. And Peter Szijjártó, I can't pronounce his surname, the foreign minister of Hungary, has stated this. And so, but to be honest, Hungary is a big surprise for all of us here in the Eastern Border and all the people in the post-Soviet sphere, since, well, they also were invaded by the Soviets. And, you know, remember the 50s? Their uprising being crushed by tanks? I don't know what's happening in Hungary. And at the same time, Italian oil and gas company Eni is ready to open a ruble account in Gazprom Bank to pay for the gas, reported by Bloomberg. But I don't know. I don't know really, because Italy is apparently very dependent on Russian gas, but Russia has been using this gas as a weapon, and they've been pretending to be nice and everything. But I don't know. I just hope to give you these news about the people who actually are now funding all this war. In contrast, something, well, kind of unexplained happening, because it's mostly Chinese as far as I know. The magazine AliExpress, which is a huge market from where a lot of people in Russia buy their all-important goods from China, yeah, they've stopped taking cards of the Russian banks who are under sanctions. At the same time, Russians can use something called a QIWI, QIWI, payment system, which is something of a Russian PayPal thing, as far as I know. It's really popular in Russia because it's anonymous and doesn't have the same standards as PayPal does. Since, well, for example, just to keep you in the loop, when I get my donations, they all go to PayPal, and I had to prove to PayPal where I live that I'm not funding terrorism, had to send them pictures of my passport, my declared address, and had to send them my bills. It was a pretty difficult trip to get this whole system started, so quite happy about that. And QIWI is used by a lot of scammers, and it's kind of popular in Russia, but hey, that's at least interesting. The cosmetics company Coty which runs the popular brands of Max Factor and Rimmel, is also just now announced that they will also leave the Russian market. Right now, I don't even know. Right now, you can count the number of companies that have actually stayed in the Russian markets on a finger in one hand, I think. I don't know. Currently, because of how many Russian companies are leaving Russia, about 600,000 people already have been gone on a suspension or a leave or are under risk of being fired. And in total, the measurements and countments order in Russia, that's that economy thing, that's the guys who respond for the economy. Alexei Kudrin, one of the more financial people, have stated that the fall of the Russian economy in 2022, as you can kind of, you know, administer now, would be about 8.8%. Inflation, well, in comparison to the basic prognosis, will be about 20.7%. However, well, this is Kudrin, and these are official data. And at this point, inflation is already 11.32% at this stage, and it's just late April. However, well, the real prices on quite a lot of stuff have actually increased way more than that. But, you know, sanctions are really working. And also, this is impacting telecommunications sphere in Russia, since the operators of mobile networks, they have increased all the prices on existing tariffs on average on about 10%, and that is basically, you know, related to this whole war and sanctions. At the same time, one of the biggest hit spheres in Russian economy due to sanctions have been actually movie theaters. That's interesting, because apparently the industry reports that in the next 2 months, about half of all the cinemas in Russia can be closed, since no one goes there, since you can't show American movies. And Russian movies are, well, I watch them, sadly, because I have to now and then, and some of them are really great, but most of them are basically trash. It's just crazy. And a municipal deputy in one of the Moscow districts, Alexei Gorinov, was also arrested and sent to prison because he apparently voted against, you know, he voted against the war in one of the statements. You know, they had to make a statement about the war in the municipal councils, and he voted against this, so now he's gotten himself arrested. But those are the economy news. Let's switch on my friend Igor Girkin to talk about the exact stuff going on the front lines. So, here are reports from Mr. Girkin. And I quote his Telegram channel because I translated it just right now, just so you knew. He only speaks about the Donetsk situation because that's the only place where active fights are happening. And, well, the reason why I didn't have any very extremely journalistic close-up episodes on this was because nothing much was happening, but now situation has changed. The region in the bit south of Izium, and yes, it might be good for you to open a map of this conflict to understand the locations, because, well, in audio format, I can't really explain where everything is, but if you can take a look at the map, that would be nice. Region south of Izium. Hard battles in all the perimeter of the Russian Plotsdarm are being held. Everywhere there are tactical movements. But basically about the data that's coming in to Strelkov, to Girkin, the hardest battles are happening on the right flank, in the region of the village Velikaya Kamishevaha, and possibly maybe just inside this village. And at the same time on the very edge of this Russian assault, in the center of the Plotsdarm, in the region and possibly the territory of the village of Novaya Dmitrovka. And the problem is that, as Girkin states here, after we will take this village, and our soldiers will come straight to the kind of the highway of Barvenkovo-Slavyansk, and will create a threat of capturing it. However, this will be uneasy, as all the villages over there next to this highway are basically melted together in one huge agglomeration. You need to understand that all the battles happening currently on the front lines are very deeply tied in, and they're dragging out the enemy. He speaks about the Ukrainian army here. like I said, I'm just using Igor Girkin so that you can't really say that I'm just using pro-Ukrainian for pro-Ukrainian sources. Girkin's very pro-Russian and very maniacal about this. The enemy, the Ukrainian army, has enough live forces so that not even looking at the lengthening of the front on this given theater of war, this has enough forces to not to allow the Russian forces to make deep movements inside. At the same time, the enemy, and again, he's speaking about the Ukrainian army here, Ukrainian army continues to pull back their forces with what they have left from their plotsdarm on the left coast of Sieverskaya Donetsa, from the rayon region of Liman-Yampol and Middle Donetsk Highlands, leaving the more southern positions in this theater of war to be more reinforced. Most likely, it seems that the enemy is going to pull back his forces from the territories that he wants to pull off and reinforce the positions where the Russians are making the hardest advances. The Russian Federation and the Donetsk and separatist rebels are in no condition to basically stop this in any way or form. In total, and this is the important part that you have to take away from this Girkin statement, in total, the enemy, the Ukrainians, are defending very, very skillfully, very stubbornly, and they understand the situation and they understand their soldiers. There is no panic in the armed forces of Ukraine. And it is utterly clear to Mr. Girkin here, again, very pro-Russian source, that the command, the HQ of Ukraine, have decided their pull on a of basically dragging out the war and winning time so that the maximum damage and maximum losses can be basically inflicted upon the Russian Federation at a cost of very slow loss of territory. This is basically the NATO strategy as well that NATO has planned for in this region. Is that NATO is planning on a defense in depth. They don't care that much about territory. They can lose some, but they want to drag out the fighting and cause maximum damage in manpower and loss of equipment to the Russian forces. And Ukrainians know this, and apparently, well, Igor Girkin knows this, but as Putin is not very informed about the situation, he might not know this, which, again, changes the situation quite a bit, since... Yeah, Mr. Girkin has been yelling about the fact that Russia needs mobilization, that the forces they have are not enough, and that Igor Girkin's greatest fear right now is that if Russians start to dig in, then Ukrainians can regroup themselves, get more vehicles and weapons and everything from the West, and counterattack themselves. Furthermore, Igor Girkin has now stated that the greatest fear the Russian army now has is if, for example, the Polish army or the Romanian army enters the territory of Ukraine and says, "No, guys, you are free to go off and fight the Russians. We'll take care of the security here," because in such a way, neither Polish nor Romanian forces would be involved in direct firefights with Russia. However, that would free up a lot of Ukrainian forces, and he's speaking about this in a very serious manner. And this is what they're doing. Basically, Igor Girkin states that there's going to be a lot of fighting, a lot of bloodletting, and that Russian forces are not mobile enough, as they're extremely centralized, to even focus and concentrate, and there's a lot of fortified positions and routes since Ukrainian army has been being entrenched in this region for such a long time. Also, Girkin is massively afraid of the fact that that Romanian army could, again, assault Transnistria and Moldova, and well, just handle the supplies which are stayed there they just give the supplies to Ukrainians, which would help them a lot. In the meantime, on, again, economy front, apparently Russia is now making more money from oil and gas than before the war started, since although, well, embargoes are slowly being put into order, but the price of oil and gas has increased so much that they can actually double this, and Finnish experts state that from selling in 2 months, from selling kind of hydrocarbons to EU, Russia has made about 44 billion euros, even though in the last year, at the same amount of time, well, we, as in the EU, only paid 12 billion euros to Russia. So, hey, sanctions are working in some spheres, but the oil money, well, sadly, it keeps working in Russia's favor. But in the next few days, which is why I'm only publishing the interview with John Michael Gaudier a bit later, we're gonna see more updates about how this whole Donetsk operation goes, because I expect a lot of rockets, I expect a lot of flags, and I expect a lot of fighting that I really need to report on. And to cap this one off, I actually, for the first time ever, I decided to do a thing that I should have done a long time ago. And I asked people on Twitter to, while I was recording this, to give me some questions that I could answer, maybe, and that would be interesting. There was like a lot of them, way too many for me to actually answer all of them in this episode. But I think I'll just gather them up and make a special one, just where I answer all the questions, and just make more question answering threads in the future. If you ask me a question on Twitter in one of these threads, it's quite likely that I actually might answer that if the question's, you know, answerable in a short amount of time. And first of all, I have two questions that are tied together. One of them is by the user named Kavika, and she asked, anyway, the user named Kavika, based on what you know of Putin and the government under his control, how likely do you think it is that nuclear weapons become involved in the war? And this was followed up by a question from a user, Wormhole Comics. I actually want to check out his page, because, hey, it looks like these guys make comics. And they asked, what exactly would you expect the global response to be immediately following Russian use of tactical nukes? What does day one, two following that look like? And I think that a tactical nuke is likely. Strategic nukes, not so much. I mean, global apocalypse, it's a bit too insane. And I think that Russian soldiers just might actually not pull the trigger. It's like 12 steps in the procedure for them to launch nukes. And I think somewhere something's going to melt down. And even if that happens, I don't really see a nuclear holocaust happening. Even if they decide to use strategic nuclear weapons, they'll drop maybe like 3 out of 100, and that's going to be a huge tragedy, but it's not going to be the end of the world. But the tactical nukes, yeah, I think they actually might drop a tactical nuke somewhere. If situation goes south for them, and they want to win for this 9th of May, which is another question, by the way, by Article 58, and he stated that some have said that on May 9th, Russia will celebrate a victory, others that Russia will formally declare war and general mobilization of forces. Thoughts? Well, Russia wants a victory, general mobilization on the 9th of May. I think it might happen in the background. Formal declaration of war. Not so sure about that, definitely, but a mobilization is needed if Russia actually wants to win this, because right now they're in a losing position. So, if they want to... But mobilization would lead to basically a political suicide, since Russia's all pumped up and mobilization would be deeply unpopular. That's the thing. Russia is now... As much as they don't like to admit, in the end, even if they take all their goals, like even if they take Donbass, what then? Like Igor Girkin stated in his analysis that Ukraine will just regroup and counterattack anyways. And they can't take Kiev if they're going to restart those attacks or something. And even if they take Kiev, well, like they'll be stopped on the river. I mean, there is no possible way how Russia is going to force Ukraine to capitulate here. So they either have to somehow overwhelm them with immense forces that should require mobilization, would actually start using tactical nukes. And I, for one, actually think that the use of a tactical nuke is more likely than full mobilization. You know, they'll just drop it somewhere to intimidate people. However, they won't drop anything big nearby because it's too close to Russia. And, you know, Russian people know something or two about nuclear fallout. But a tactical nuke could happen. And I don't think it'll start a nuclear war. I think that this will ensure, and I'm not sure if Putin thinks that far ahead, I think a single tactical nuke will be something that causes an outrage, causes massive aid to Ukraine, and puts every other government's nukes, you know, at a ready. If after this tactical nuke more nuclear strikes happen, then I think we're all just dead. I think that at that point NATO might actually decide to nuke something back, and then we would get a full-scale war. Or, I don't know, I'm actually hoping that CIA manages to assassinate Putin somehow. But I don't think that a response to a tactical nuke would be going back to Russia. It's just going to be 1-2 days of total disbelief. And then we can only hope that people with cooler heads prevail in the world. But yeah, quite a lot of news today. And, well, we're going to continue this. But like I said, on the 1st of May, another interview is coming. Thank you for listening, comrades. До свидания, товарищи. Please support us on Patreon. I say this in every episode, or just click the donate button on theeasternborder.lv. It's great. And please donate to the Ukrainian army and help the civilians. And if you have refugees in your town, hey, help them out too. And always remember, happiness is mandatory.